fight with Carl.
It's kind of one of those things. It's like the duck. You know, you see a duck in the water, right? The duck looks like it's cool, but the duck's freaking working hard under the water. Wow, I'm working hard, working hard. That's how our place is. We look cool, but we're working hard.
Can we bring up Bourbon Tales? Because I thought that's what we were doing.
Oh my goodness.
Are we not?
Can I refill my cocktail?
Yeah, go, please.
I mean, I know we're recording. I'm so sorry.
Jared's great at editing.
Yeah, it's good.
I had a bourbon before this. It was a long day. I'm not an alcoholic, but I'm a grown-ass woman.
This is a safe place. It's okay.
I'm a grown-ass woman. Let me just get a cocktail. I'll be right back.
Take your time.
I'll be right back.
We'll fill the air.
I didn't mean to throw that curveball in there.
No, that's great.
What you're doing.
What are you drinking, Trace?
This is actually Cedar Ridge from Iowa. It's the first bottle that Whiskey Docs got for free. So he sent it down to
there
us.
There you go. Yeah, we'll have to fill.
He gave me and Dylan both a bottle. So it was actually pretty cool.
There you go. We'll have to fill UC in on that. Whiskey Docs.
We still have to schedule something where we collab. We haven't done that yet. That seemed like an easy go-to. I think we've been podcasting for over a year now and still haven't done anything with Duck Legs.
Yeah, we'll have to do that for sure.
Okay. I am ready.
There we go.
Tyler's on mute.
Oh, Tyler's muted. We can't.
Hey, this is my first time ever working Zoom. So I have no beverage, alcoholic or non-alcoholic, but I will get water if I need to.
Yeah. Go put a lime in it or something. Make yourself feel good, you know?
Yeah, lemon, a little spritz. Yeah.
It's a virgin cocktail then. You're good.
There you go.
And so, Dr. UC, before we get started, Trace is actually a host of another podcast called Whiskey Docs as well.
So we'll have to get you on there. I didn't know you did Bourbon Tales, so I started creeping you on Instagram today.
Yeah.
So that'll have to be a thing.
Will it right now?
Oh, nice.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
I got a bourbon from Iowa. I was just saying, one of our last guests, he sent us a bottle, so that's what I'm sipping on right now. Cedar Ridge.
Nice. Okay. Mm-hmm. Is it bourbon, you said? Not yet. Yeah.
Mm-hmm. It's a bourbon.
Nice.
That's why you started the podcast, just to get free liquor, right?
Pretty much.
Okay. Hey, man. That's a bonus side effect. I like that.
Well, Dr. UC, as we get this stuff rolling here, and how do you prefer? You prefer Dr. UC? Do you prefer... How do you pronounce your first name? I'm gonna let you say that.
I'm very Nigerian, so I have a very Nigerian name. It's Uchenna, like Uchenna. But everyone calls me UC. Mm-hmm. Everyone, my parents call me UC. Like, I only get Uchenna when they're really unhappy with me.
Yikes! Yeah.
And I'm so grown, and I get that every once in a while.
So that's a childhood nickname. Right.
It's a childhood. Yeah. It was out of necessity because I went in kindergarten. My teacher, Mrs. K, she told my father that the kids were having a hard time pronouncing my name. And my dad was like, well, just call her UC, because my full name is Uchenna Cynthia Owele Osai. But so my dad's like, just take UC and then, or the first two letters of my name, whatever works. And it stuck.
Awesome. Yeah. Where were you born?
I was born and raised in Dallas. Mm-hmm. And then I left as soon as my feet could carry me after school. And yeah.
Didn't like Dallas at all?
No. Okay. I don't want to throw shade to Dallas. Dallas is a special place and it has its special ways. Yeah. I just wanted an experience that would stretch me, that would make me uncomfortable. So I knew that I wanted to go to the East Coast because I knew they had a physical therapy program, and I can tell you all about how that ended up. and so I went to Boston University, which was the best decision I ever made.
Yeah, awesome. And yeah, I think it's about 2 years ago, Tyler and I were in New Orleans for a CSM, maybe 3 years ago now, dang. And we ran into Dr. Sandy Hilton, who I'm sure you've met.
Yes, and hung out with. My girl. Yes.
And we were talking, and she was like, "Oh my God, you follow UC Logic, right?" And I was like, "Who? What's this? Who's that?" And ever since then, I've been the biggest fan, especially as a fellow Austinite right now.
Oh man! So,
yeah, just been loving all the content ever since.
Thank you
for sure.
Thank you.
We'll let you kind of give yourself your own introduction as well.
Oh, sure. So I guess first and foremost, I'm a pelvic health physical therapist, and I'm assistant professor at University of Texas Dell Medical School in the Department of Women's Health. But I'm also manager of the pelvic health program for UT Health Austin, so the clinical arm of the med school. And I am adjunct faculty at the University of Michigan in their School of Social Work for their sexual health certification program. And lastly, I am founder of UC Logic, which is a sex education platform, online sex education platform that's really focused on adults and improving their sexual intelligence and affirming their sexuality.
That's one thing we get we do that really well in America is sex education. Right?
Oh, we do it so good. It's out of line how bad it is. Out of line.
I like how you could only hold that bit for like a minute or like a second, and then it was like, no, it's atrocious. I can't even joke about it.
It's like ridiculous. It's ridiculous.
When you went into PT, did you go into PT school thinking, you know, I want to do something in the sex education space as well?
Or
the
pelvic I went to PT school only to do pelvic health. It was really just, that's what got me. I didn't know much about physical therapy, but I did an internship when I was with Kathy Tisco, Park City's physical therapy in Dallas. I was 15 and I was her little intern for the summer. And I honestly thought it was like a sports clinic because I played soccer and it ended up being a pelvic health clinic. And I was like, oh snap. And I told my mom, my mom was like, how is it? You know, well, she's Nigerian. So she's like, oh, darling, how was it? How was it? Nice? Was it wonderful? You know, and I was like, no, mommy, I saw a couple of penises and a lot of vaginas. And she's like, well, people have genitals and you need to understand how they work. So continue commitment.
Yes.
And I did. And you know what? Kathy is the reason why I'm here today. So I will be forever grateful to her for her mentorship and her allowing this 15-year-old drip-nosed child be her PT tech.
That's awesome.
Yeah.
And I was about to say, what a sex positive comment too from your mom.
Yeah. My mom, the little African, that's what my sister and I call her. She's tiny but mighty. And she was our first sex educator. Like, she was that crunk mother when you were like 8 or 9 and she's like, okay, these are your genitals, you know, and this is, they look like all of this. There are all these pictures of your genitals. And, you know, my sister and I are Catholic, or we raised Catholic. And so my mom was like, you know, don't have sex until marriage. But if you do have sex, it should be pleasurable. And if but don't do it, you know, like, it was very confusing, you know, like she's a chemist, so she's like scientist, but she's also crazy Catholic. And not that Catholics are crazy, but my mom she goes to church like 3 times a week. So, you know, so it was really interesting growing up. So my sister and I basically grew up confused, but clear that we had autonomy over our bodies and that pleasure wasn't bad. And, you know, we could still be who we are. And that was okay. Being sexual was okay.
Yeah. Do you think we're doing a better job as a society confusing kids less about sex and who they are? Okay.
No.
Hey, I was hoping for some positive, like some upward trend.
I think that people are accessing knowledge about sex more now. But people have to work through the fact that sex is not just, you know, it's deeper than the acts of sex. It's sex is your beliefs, how you were raised, You know, it is your, it influences your race, influences your sex, your sexuality, your religion, you know, your health. Everything influences your beliefs and sex and your body, you know? And I think that people don't get that message soon enough. And as a pelvic health physical therapist, I see a lot of patients come in where they say, oh, I'm peeing my pants, I'm doing this. And they say, well, you know, I'm like, well, how is your orgasm function? And they're like, what are you talking about? I'm like, well, are you able to achieve orgasms? They're like, no, I've never achieved the orgasm. I'm like, okay, is that distressing to you? They're like, what do you mean? I'm like, does it bother you? And they're like, well, yeah, but what can I do about that? And for me, I'm just thinking, wow, you know, that, and I'm not saying an orgasm is a measure of a good sex life, not at all. But I think people deprioritize their sexual health because they don't think it's as valid as their cardiac health or anything. And people who have any type of sexual dysfunction do not view themselves as healthy people. They could have perfect, you know, hemoglobin A1C, their blood pressure is perfect, everything. But if they are having a little bit of sexual dysfunction, they don't view themselves as healthy. And that's something we all need to really think about and consider. Yeah.
For sure.
I'm going to jump off my soapbox.
No, please. This is what it's about. It's all soapbox. It's all soapbox tonight. And I'm sorry, I'm blanking on the sex education degree that you have. What is that called again? I'm sorry. I can't remember.
No. I it's actually not a degree. I actually took the University of Michigan Sexual Health Certification Program. And honestly, I can't remember. I think it was either 4 years ago, or I think I finished 4 years ago, maybe. As I think I was 6 years into being a PT. And I realized, you know, I saw the program actually a few years before I even applied. Like I was kind of lusting at it from afar, but I felt like I needed to have more experience in the clinic with my patients to see, like, is this something that I really wanted to invest my money and a year of my time in doing and participating in. And so I finally jumped into it, and all I wanted to learn was the didactics. Like what do I need to learn about sex? I wanted to know the basics. I wanted to know about, you know, sexual health across the gender spectrum. You know, I wanted to learn how to interview my patients in terms of their sexual issues. I wanted to understand what resources were out there. I wanted to understand what mental health, what sex therapists actually did. You know, I wanted to learn. And I had done a residency. You know, I did a pelvic health residency at WashU, and they were amazing, and I learned so much. But there wasn't this type of structured didactic circled around sexual health. And so I took the program simply to just get information. I really didn't care about certifications, because in the physical therapy world, no one had. You know, we had Tali Rosenbaum, who is in Israel, and she was a physical therapist turned psychotherapist. But we didn't have a ton of people with this. So I didn't see them. For me, when I took the class or the course, I didn't see the value in it. But then the director, Sally Foley, she said, you see, we don't have PTs with a ton of PTs with this certification in sexuality counseling. You should really look into getting your certification. I was like, I don't know, Sally. I'm not trying to do anything crazy. I just wanted to get this information. And so, of course, she talked me into it, and I did it. And I turned it into my practice. So I feel like I can give my patients a totally different level of care and at least affirmation in what they're experiencing, especially when it comes to their sex lives.
So is like... sexual physical therapy, is there like exercises, or is it more education, reassurance? Is it like the typical PT thought process of like you're going to give them a HEP? Like what is like a plan of care, I guess, look for a sexual physical therapist?
Sure. And the thing is, everyone can be a sexual physical therapist. It just depends on, you know, how your comfort level in addressing it. And so for me in that space, so part of my intake, so my evaluation, we ask, you know, and as a pelvic PT, I'm already in a very protected space to do this, right? If you're an ortho PT, it's a little different. You know, I'm in a closed like room where it's just the two of us or the three of us if they bring their partner, you know, talking about very personal things. So I have the luxury of saying, you know, asking about their poop, their pee. So when you're already asking people about their poop and their pee, asking them about sex is not a big leap. And so, you know, I ask them, I have a detailed history. And so if they have pain or trauma or body image issues, let's say that, you know, the validated outcome measures for depression was high and anxiety was high, right? And so, but I also gave them a validated outcome measure for sexual function. And it's like their genital body image is in the toilet. So if you think something, if you think your penis or your vulva is like gross and ugly, you're not, your sexy swagger is going to be off. So it might be, you know, yeah, I'm going to give them maybe pelvic floor exercises to address their incontinence or their, you know, fecal or urinary, or I might work on like, you know, self manual therapy techniques to help address their pelvic pain. But then I might also say, like, let's talk about your value. Like, let's talk about your genitals. Like, why do you think your genitals are so are ugly? Like, where does that come from? You know, and, you know, like, I want you to investigate that and think about how does that impact your pain? How does that impact your ability to connect with your pelvic floor? Because you have a huge disconnect. So think about that. Let's wrap that into their HEP and see. And it's not like I'm saying, I'm not doing deep dive psychotherapy. I just want them to understand the connections and that all that is relevant. And so for our patients, and then also if they have elevated anxiety measures and depression measures, I also work in a multidisciplinary clinic where I have a licensed clinical social worker across the hall. So I can say, okay, hey, colleague of mine, you know, this patient has elevated, you know, patient-reported outcomes in anxiety and depression. And I've talked to the patient about it, and the patient's like, yes, I'm open to talking to your therapist. So I pull Myra in the room. I step out. She does a quick meet and greet. She comes out. We discuss, and she's like, yeah, I've made an appointment. I'm like, great. Do you think we should wait on PT? She's like, no, let's continue PT. We'll do the therapy collectively. Sometimes the patient has deep-rooted psychotherapy needs so that they start with that and then they circle back with me later when they're ready. So it's really, it depends on the patient's needs, but it's not so separate. It may be just kind of planting a seed for them and saying, you know what, I'm going to serve as a bridge for you because you might need some more support from a licensed mental health professional, but I can do with the basic psychoeducation. All PTs can do the basic psychoeducation. They can say like, yeah, like this is your vulva, this is your penis, this is how long it takes to orgasm. So you expecting yourself to like last for 2 hours is a little unrealistic. And so we're gonna kind of, you know, manage that expectation so you don't feel so bad about yourself. You know?
Do you have to fight a lot of people on that?
I have in the past. I have in the past. I've had to talk a couple people off ledges and I'm like, you know, like this is how a 2 hour session can go, but you can't be going the whole 2 hours, you know, like that's just not helpful.
And that's kind of like the goal of your Instagram. It seemed like of just like baseline education, making it something easy to talk about. Like, it seems like you're pretty relatable and make it a little bit less taboo. Cause like you're throwing out like penis, vagina, vulva terms. It's like, you're not going to hear that if you go into an ortho clinic typically, but like if you're, like, I noticed you get a decent amount of engagement on stuff too. So it's like people are listening and it might be sort of a safe space too, because they can view your content without, you know, having to go to a therapist, having to go somewhere to talk about it.
Absolutely. And like I said, it's almost a bridge because I get a lot of DMs. I get a lot of emails. So even though, you know, I try to make it as comfortable as possible, people still don't feel so comfortable publicly putting their stuff out there. And so that's why, you know, I have a separate, part of UC Logic is I do one-on-one sex counseling. So it's not mental health counseling. It's really just what's going on. Okay, here's what I think the education deficits are. I can provide you with those deficits. We'll see how we do over 2 or 3 visits. And then if you feel like, yeah, you know, this is a great, I can work on this and do my thing. Or I might say, you know what? I think you're ready to work with a mental health provider. So it's almost like I'm just like a safe bridge. where some people may not feel like they don't need the mental health, but then they realize working with me that they actually do. And then I connect them with who they need to be connected with, or it's simply just an education deficit that I can support them with.
I know, Laura, you've been, you can go ahead and introduce yourself too as well, because I don't think we got a full introduction of you, but you are also wanting to do more work in that space as well, correct?
Yeah, so I am a fitness instructor.
Hey!
So my background is in yoga and Pilates. I've also taught bar and spin. I've done a little bit of body work. And in Austin, I've taught at studios that primarily are women who are coming in, a lot of women in childbearing age. And so I've done a lot of work with pregnant women and a lot of work with women post-pregnancy. And so just by kind of occupying that space with them for so long, I've learned a lot. And so I'm at this point, I'm actually at this interesting transition point in my career where I am moving out of a studio space and more into kind of building my own business and doing one-on-one work. Yes. And I'm finding there's a huge market for people who just don't understand what is your pelvic floor? Why is it important? Why would I want to think about it pre-pregnancy, during pregnancy, post-pregnancy? And so I have a few clients right now and they're all kind of in that area that we're tapping into those muscles and that awareness. And it is really interesting.
It's really interesting. People hold a lot of stuff.
For sure.
A lot of stuff, particularly when you're thinking about women and vagina owners and uterus owners. You know, I wrote this article for Speaks, well, formerly Thinks Underwear, where I was talking that shame, sexual shame, particularly for women, vagina owners, and uterus owners, is very, like, it's a cultural phenomenon, right? It's,
yeah,
it's
for
like
sure.
Part of our fiber of just the world, not just the U.S., like worldwide.
Mm-hmm.
That area is kind of sort of like keep yourself pristine, right? Keep that, don't get pregnant, you know, don't masturbate. Whereas boys, it's like, okay, masturbate, you're fine, do that, you know, all that, that's affirmed. But like for women, it's not. And so there's a whole lot there, because especially when you're asking someone to be aware of their pelvic floor, like they say, I have pelvic pain, you know, half the time, you know, my female patients can't really specifically tell me where that pain is. Because they're not really tuned in to their genitals.
For sure. Well, I know, like, I've been working with a few clients, and like one of them on our very first session, we were literally just, I was like, I just explained what her pelvic floor is, how it should feel when you contract it. And we were just doing breathing exercises, like really simple, didn't get into anything too complicated. And she literally said to me, how is this not a requirement for every single woman who wants to get pregnant? And I was like, I don't know. Like, it should be.
It should be a requirement in all training for anyone who works with bodies.
Yeah, for sure. Absolutely.
Anyone who works with a body should have this education, because if we all were informed and understood at least the fundamentals, so many people, and we can help them avoid years of heartache and shame. Because
yeah,
it takes any person, particularly women, to find the right provider to help take care of their needs, it's about 7 to 8 years.
Wow.
So that's a long time.
Just to get comfortable finding a provider that...
Just to get someone to address their needs. So I think that we all need to... Sorry, I have correcting my... It's 6 years, 6 to 7 years, not 7 to 8, 6 to 7 years. But and we all need to get comfortable with this, and that, and it starts with our education programs, whether it's certification programs, whether it's master's programs, doctoral programs. They all, like pelvic health should be part of that. If you're doing any type of body work, pelvic health should be included. If you learn about the glutes, you need to learn about the pelvic floor.
Pelvic floor is just as important as glute med.
It is, though.
If not more.
Yeah.
It is, though. It's a loyal gangster. Your pelvic floor is a loyal gangster.
Yeah.
Is like, if your back ain't right, your pelvic floor is going to compensate or decompensate sometimes. Mm-hmm. Right? If your hips ain't right, your pelvic floor is going to tell you everything. If your abs are doing too much, pelvic floor is going to react.
You know? What was the cause of that separation? Why have the two been so separated? Right? Almost, is it the Western, Eastern philosophies?
It's puritanical BS. You know, I think that it's really about that. Like, people don't want to, you know, they don't want to talk about the genital area because it's not appropriate. I'm like, it's totsaprobes. We all poop, we all pee, we all have sexy time in our own way. Everyone's fabulous, right? So why aren't we asking about those basics? You know, if you're working neuropopulation, you need to know about, you need to help them out with sex and pooping and peeing.
Mm-hmm.
Pelvic floors.
Well, yeah. It's interesting because I've been reading, or I have the book, The Vagina Bible. I'm sure you've heard of it.
Oh,
and
yeah.
I know that, especially in the medical field, that it just wasn't studied until a lot, like, more recently.
Yeah.
Again, because of that puritanical, like, oh, it's not, like, appropriate, or most of the cadavers were men, or they were older women who had, you know, the muscle tone had gotten less, so they just didn't think it was important.
Right.
And so, like, that, like, those puritanical beliefs have just seeped so deep into our research. But like it's only been fairly recently that we've even known that the pelvic floor even like was something to consider in a.
Absolutely.
It's crazy.
Yeah.
This reminds me like it's just like healthcare was viewed through the male gaze, right?
For so long.
Absolutely. Yeah. And then when you think about, you know, how a lot of our, particularly in the field of gynecology, a lot of their advancements were, their experiments were performed on black slaves without anesthesia, right? Without their consent. The C-section fistula repairs, those were perfected on black women without informed consent. And so we have to understand that there's a lot when it comes to our bodies. There's a lot that goes into under our permission to explore our bodies. Like I said before, there are racial components, there are ethnic components, there are religious components, gender components. So those are very real. Because when I lecture, when I lecture at Michigan, when I lecture at UT, when I do, you know, plenary talks, like I always bring up those pieces. We have to look at it from an intersectional perspective. We can't forget, like, you know, how we present in the world influences the information we get back to us. And we all have to think about that. Everyone has to think about that. Every human has to think about that and be aware of that.
There's so many parallels between, you know, this, we talk about our shame that's all centered around sexual health, sexism and racism. There's just so many parallels of how all of this is all intertwined. And for the folks that, you know, therapeutic pain science education is so hot right now and taken in I'm a biopsychosocial model practitioner. It's like, okay, cool. Are you also incorporating this stuff as well?
Right.
That's so hard and messy to talk about.
It's messy, but it's not. Like, I was at the San Diego Pain Summit. I was invited to speak about racism and you know, and I forget what we titled the talk. It was with Sandy Hilton, Maxi Michik, and Mark Milligan. And we wanted to call it Pissing People Off or something like that, but we were classier about it.
Oh.
And we talked about, you know, microaggressions, macroaggressions, colorism, all of that. And it was at a pain conference. And it was, I mean, I feel like it was well received, but it was really exhausting and hard because there are a lot of emotions wrapped around recognizing our mutually inherited advantages and disadvantages. And recognizing that our pain is not a uniform experience. We all know intellectually it's a unique, individualized experience, but then we really have to understand like how systems of oppression can influence one's experience of pain, but then also how one addresses an individual's experience of pain. And that requires internal work that isn't sexy, and you can't throw it into like an academic software, and you can't necessarily quantify it really well with, you know, like p-values, isn't that great? You know, like there's lots of ways that, you know, we want to fight against that because it's hard to make it super tangible, but it's there. And makes words about that stuff.
So is healthcare getting better regarding that now that we're having these conferences and you're speaking at more conferences now? Hopefully you're not going to shoot this down like my other question.
I mean, look, okay.
You can shoot it down. It's okay. It's fine.
I've been speaking about this for like 6 years. You have no idea how many talks I've given on this. Like tons. And I'm very happy that people are, their ears are open and their eyes are open. So I hope that in the next, you know, few years, we'll start to see some shifts and people get comfortable with being uncomfortable and then say, you know what? I need to rethink this. I need to rethink everything and approach it from a different perspective. So do I think healthcare is getting better as a whole? Well, we have to address the systems of oppression for healthcare to get better. Which means we have to start at home. We have to be willing to give up our power. We have to be willing to give up our social capital. We have to be willing to say we're wrong. I mean, I'm wrong all the time, except when I'm not wrong. So I'm not wrong about this. I'm just saying.
Yep. Ooh, Trace, at the VA, do you get into any pelvic or sexual health? Because at the VA, I know you see a lot of things coming at you.
There's a lot of referrals for it. And prior to, I'd say probably the last 2 years, they were taking on the pelvic floor stuff, but no one was a pelvic floor therapist. It was a lot of, here's your Kegel home exercise program. Mm-hmm. And since I've been there, whenever I'm screening consults, I forward it out to community care. And it's like, this is a specialty we don't offer in this facility, because I've gotten 2 pelvic floor cases, 1 male, 1 female, neither of which I felt I could help. The female, I thought enough through the subjective that she was comfortable talking to me about it. She knew why she was there. It seemed sort of like stress incontinence. Mm-hmm. So I went with, here's what I would do, but I'm going to refer you to a physical therapist that specializes in this, because this is something we can handle. It's just not my specialty. There's a reason people go into this. That is not what I do. Here is baseline. It probably isn't going to hurt you from the way you're describing your case to do this. If it starts to flare anything up, stop and wait till you get to the specialist. Mm-hmm. So I very much take the approach of, I mean, I'm fairly open with all of my patients if they present with something, because at the VA, it's like, I'll have people that say, you know, I've had headaches for 20 years. Well, what happened for your headache? Well, a bomb went off by my head. It's like, well, I don't know how to deal with that. Like, well, what happened? How did you start developing these issues? So far, it's been, you know, pregnancy, or I've just gotten older and this has happened. Yeah. But there are a lot of veterans with military sexual trauma from being a POW or something like that. I haven't had to have that conversation. It's one I'm not comfortable with. And I told my boss that. It's like, this is not, there's a reason there are specialists in this. I am not one of them, and I'm not going to see them. Like, I will send them to community care. So it's been pretty well received by our management too, of like, this isn't just like, oh, you need to see a PT. It's like, oh, you need to see a specialist. Like, this isn't just a thing that we do. So.
Absolutely. Absolutely. And I think what's really unfortunate, I think, is that, you know, it's hard to get access. You know, I'm at a state institution, but it's still difficult to access me because we take mostly internal referrals, because there's so few of us. And I'm trying to expand that, but, you know, recruiting a pelvic health PT is challenging, because like once somebody finds a place they love and they stay there. And so it's having to kind of do that work, but then also building the structure to kind of make sure that people thrive and grow. And I totally hear what you're saying, because you're like, there's a lot of trauma that's wrapped up in, you know, what these patients are coming to you with. And you're like, you know what? I can help you with this fundamental piece, but I'm going to send you on your way here, you know, and then finding that, like, what's even trickier is that not all pelvic PTs have any training in, like, trauma-informed care.
Yeah. And that was another thing that I've learned is, like, the VA, just from talking with, like, Jared and Tyler, like, the VA population, that's not normal outpatient ortho. So I can only imagine normal outpatient pelvic health, where you've seen a lot of postpartum, and then it comes in with, you know, POW trauma, you're dealing with all of that. It's like, that's a whole other can of worms that you have to know how to address, because otherwise you're not serving that patient well. So
it's
tricky, because we don't have, I mean, there's very few pelvic floor PTs that I know in the VA system, because it's mostly like the VA and the military services a whole is mostly male dominated. So it's been here recently. Probably last 20 years where women's health has had like their own clinic. They've developed like their own programs, but it's still kind of up and coming. So
absolutely.
They're getting there, but it's, I mean, like I said, some of my colleagues have said for the last 20 years, it's been, here's your Kegel home exercise program. There you go. You've gotten pelvic floor physical therapy. And it's like, that's not what it is anymore. There's a lot more out there.
Absolutely.
I think I know it's that ego thing too. I know Tyler and I, we used to work at the same clinic, and one of the, we're talking to one of the residency directors. And, I mentioned like, hey, I had a client come in, and, it was a pelvic health referral, and our clinic didn't offer that. Do you know any providers in the area? This is before I knew you and Sullivan and Hands On. And his response was like, oh, anybody, you know, that has a residency training should be able to handle that. And I was like, I don't think that's the right answer. I don't think that was correct. I'm not going to talk to you anymore. And I think Tyler knows who I'm talking about. Tyler, anything you want to add from things that you've seen in ortho right now?
No, I just want to confirm that was a real thing. And there are people out there that think that way, and it's, I don't know.
Yeah. No, you know, it's funny. I mean, I'm residency trained, but I don't think I don't believe that if we were going to judge PTs by their residency training, that's a sad state to to be in. I think that, you know, I look for a healthcare provider that is responsive and thoughtful. And that's who I refer my patients to, and period. You know, I mean, and I and again, even in most spaces that I've been in the pelvic PT world, everyone's pretty supportive. I think it's just a matter of, but we're all spread out, right? We're all spread out. And it's hard to have communities in some places because, you know, like you have like large private practice systems and you have like, you know, public health systems, and it's very, very tricky to get that community down. So I think a lot of us, we go to like the combined section meetings and those conferences to kind of be like, hey, you know, what's down? But I think that's the one weakness that I can say that I've, for myself, since I moved here to Austin 3 years ago, is that I need to kind of, you know, spread my wings more in terms of like really getting to know more people. Like I know Janice Mitchell from My Pelvic Floor Muscles, and she's amazing. But I think that's been a challenge. But I also know from my personal development, I came here to UT to be on faculty in a med school, to change how they train their OB-GYN residents in terms of pelvic health, and to develop a program and build a program for pelvic floor physical therapy, you know, in a brand new medical system. So that was my focus the past few years. But I think, you know, every season changes. So now my next season or the next step would be establishing community.
It's needed for sure.
Absolutely.
What was your journey like transitioning from growing up in a Catholic religious household to becoming more of an open-minded person that's able to maybe accept same-sex marriage and breaking down those standards that you grew up with?
Well, I must correct. My mom was very conservative, yet very liberal. So I think, you know, she was Catholic, but a scientist first. And so everything needed to make sense from a scientific perspective from her, and even though she's a devout Catholic. But I think the core value in my home was decency and humanity. And that was a core value. And I was very lucky in that my parents allowed my sister and I to go to an all-girl prep school where we had nuns on campus. And I know that sounds ridiculous as when you're in high school, but it was a wonderful, for me as an individual, I loved that experience because, you know, it was centered on service and community. Even though we were wild and crazy Catholic schoolgirls, we were still, that was the value. And, you know, I think I had an active mother who really was committed to making sure her kids contributed to the world in some capacity. You know, my sister is a criminal defense attorney, and, you know, she believes in justice for all, and she does everything she can to do that. And I try to affirm people by acknowledging their identities and making sure that they don't feel shame in who they are and wanting more for themselves, whether that's their sexuality or just who they are as humans. But I think I've also struggled growing up in mostly white spaces and being a Black woman. And, you know, I've gone through the phases of internalized racism. You know, like I did a webinar earlier this week talking about anti-racism, and I said, you know, growing up, I was told I have to be twice as good, I have to be three times as good. And I know that my parents were trying to gas me up, but like that tells a kid very clearly you're not as good. So you have to work just as hard, or not just as hard, like way harder to get the same thing. And so, you know, I mean, I remember thinking to myself, like, I'm gonna be a good Black kid, and I'm gonna make people forget that I'm Black, which is just heartbreaking, right? And thank God, like I grew out of that, like, you know, but it was a real struggle to kind of have your identity. And I had like, I mean, my house was basically like United Nations, you know, my parents had people from all over the world coming in. It was also like little Nigeria. So I was around all, you know, but I wasn't around that during the day. You know, I was in a different society, a different world. you know, from 7 a.m. to 8 o'clock.
It was Dallas. It's a different
world. It's Dallas. It's Dallas, you know? So, you know, and it's Dallas proper, right? So, like, it's a whole other beast out there. You know, it's hard out there in those streets. I think that's partially why I so desperately, like, wanted to get out. I wanted something a little different from my little bubble. And I ran towards it, not away. I ran towards something, not away from anything.
Oh, that's awesome. And sorry, man. Go ahead.
Yeah, I'll just kind of give another one with that is growing up in those white spaces, and you had an Instagram post about this recently. Is there anything that you, any action steps and some immediate steps that those individuals in those white areas that you feel like need to happen first and foremost to get the ball rolling more in that direction? Anything that comes to mind?
Yeah, I mean, I've said this before, but like fragility is not bad. Like when people hear white fragility, they're like, I'm weak. And it's like, no, you just aren't weathered to what Black people have to deal with all the time. And learning and being aware, when I talked about inherited advantage and disadvantages, it's just white fragility means that your humanity is never questioned. And it's very uncomfortable to look at someone else who's equally human and their humanity is always questioned fundamentally in every system. And so I want people to kind of embrace that fragile part. And it's people say, man, I'm exhausted. It's exhausting. Yeah, it's okay to be exhausted. You're not used to this. I might as well be the like seasoned marathon runner. You know, I've been doing this, like I do 26.2 miles every week and you're a couch potato. You know, you just gotta train up, homie. Suit up.
Yeah, it's training. It's like hitting people over the head, especially in the PT community. I think they're starting to get that this is graded exposure.
Graded exposure. It's like, baby, you're not going to be an expert in a week. Oh, please. I am, like I said before, I'm a grown-ass woman. I've been doing this since, like, the minute I came out of my mom's holy place, okay? And I've been watching white people my entire life. It is part of my survival to understand you all. It is not part of your survival to understand me and my experience. And now you are starting to realize, oh damn. And so I think like the action steps is to like, right now you feel like you're drinking from a fire hose. You are. Pace yourself. You know, right now everyone's like, don't ask Black people to help. And I think it's like, we know that is in everyone's best interest to help you, but we just need a minute to just like recover from the trauma. Sorry, my light. And then we'll be fine and we'll help you out. But I think like the first piece is like being okay with being fragile. Really, really look at multiple sources and recommendations on like how you learn best. Like just think of it as self-improvement. How do I learn best? I personally love documentaries. Right? So like, if I'm a person that like loves to learn by like visual, then like focus on that visual stuff. Like go back to what you, like, how do you learn best? Do you like podcasts? And find all the dopest podcasts you can find. If you're a reader, there are a ton of books that you can read. Right? And I mean, I haven't, and the thing is, everyone's like, well, what did you think of this book? I'm like, I haven't read it. I already know this. I live this. They're just smart enough to put it on paper and I got they make a shit ton of money. Excuse my language. You know?
Oh yes.
You know, like I live this. Like, you know, so like, I mean, and I'm not saying I don't read. Of course, I've read a lot of books. Like, I personally, I think there's a book that no one is mentioning. It's called Savage Inequalities by Jonathan Kozol. And it is excellent. And it talks about the education system. So I think anyone in any form of education should read that book. It's eye-opening. It's sobering. I read it in PT school. And it really informed a lot of what I do. And, you know, I think that that's just, I think people just need to kind of design your own plan. And just know that it's not a side hustle what you're doing. This is a life hustle. This is a life hustle. You know, and of course, you know, I'm like seasoned in like lowering people in warm bath water about their nonsense. Like, I'm fine with that. I'm going on vacation next week. I'm going to recharge, but I'll be back with full energy. But like, you know, but like, understand that like, it takes a lot out of us to live this life. And then it takes a lot out of us to teach y'all, even though we've been telling you for like ever. And so many people have died in this effort. Oh, and one thing, please watch I Am Not Your Negro, please. That's just like one of, like next to 13th, I feel like that is the documentary that everyone should be watching.
Like anything about Baldwin is just.
Oh my goodness.
Just so good.
It was just a treasure to the world.
The metaphors you're dropping too, I'm loving them so much. The metaphors have been so good.
I'm a little, I have my cocktail.
There we go.
A little freer.
This right is an now. Extended bourbon tale.
This is an extent. Yes, queen. Yes, this is extended bourbon tales.
That's awesome. How'd you come up with that name? Did that just come?
You know, I'm kind of in love with bourbon, or my colleague Teresa calls it brown water. And depending on the day, she'll be like, "You getting some brown water tonight?" And I'm like, "Absolutely, my queen." I love bourbon, and I would talk with my friends about sexy time all the time. And I just thought, well, I didn't want to make it so clinical. Like everyone, like I looked up in social media and I was like, God, people talk about sex. It's like either like really like in your face, which I know is intimidating for most people. And I was like, or it's like too clinical. So I was like, well, bourbon tales, like most people like a Bev, even if it's a non-alcoholic Bev. And if I drink cocktails and make it casual, they'll feel more comfortable.
Yeah.
You know, and every answer I have is evidence-based. It's not, I mean, there are a few questions where it's like, just like life experience and just me being a human. But a lot of the answers I give are based on like, you know, true academic rigor. So it's not just like, well, I just figured this out. Like I really have to prepare and think about it.
It's a doc. It's from a doctor. These are bourbon. These are doctor level bourbon tales.
Oh, absolutely, absolutely. You know, I think what's funny. I love getting questions about, you know, relationships, and like how you navigate a partner. I mean, most of it is, how do I navigate my partner's quirks? And it's really interesting how, like, what I've learned over the past almost three and a half years of doing, you know, UC Logic is that, you know, everyone comes with their own sexual footprint. And we don't always understand them, especially going into a relationship. And for some people, it's a natural, like, you know, fusion. And for others, they struggle. And that struggle doesn't necessarily mean that you're not, you know, equally yoked. It just means that, like, there's different ways that you express and experience your sexuality and different comfort levels. And sometimes people need a little help with that. And so I think people just don't give themselves enough grace. You know, and kind of just be a little humble and be like, you know, I don't know. I don't know how to do this. I don't understand. I don't know the anatomy very well. Or You know, I thought we're supposed to have simultaneous orgasms. We're not supposed to have simultaneous orgasms. Like, you know, like things like that. And so, where I'm not supposed to last 2 hours straight, like I can do like my 10 minutes. Of,
I told you that in confidence, UC.
Their social security is, I'm just kidding.
Well, we're coming up on our hour. I have one more question. Does anybody else have a question? Anything else to get out? Good, good. Excuse me. So this anti-racism movement momentum is feeling pretty strong. Mm-hmm. A lot is happening. A lot of protests. Mm-hmm. Some people are comparing it to the civil rights movement of the 60s. I don't know if that's a fair comparison. Does this feel like change is, like true change is on the way? How do you feel about this momentum that's coming up?
I am not the person to ask because I am very young. I think that the people to ask are the people who were in the fight in the 60s, and that would be Angela Davis, the Al Sharptons, Jesse Jacksons, the Gloria Steinems. And I know Angela Davis did make a statement, and she said, this feels different. This feels like progress. She's never seen this worldwide, you know, I mean, she's never seen it like this. And I actually am hopeful, because never, I will say this, never in my lifetime has anyone really asked me about racism in a real, I want to learn way. I want to be better way. This is the first time my experience and knowledge is actually sought out after in a way where people want to better themselves. And the collective strength of the Black community calling people out in ways that honor who they are as individuals, I'm just so proud of us. And I hope that things move forward. I will continue to do what I do, you know, and I will continue to elevate my game. I will continue to strive for excellence, as I'm sure everyone is going to try and do.
Thank you, UC. We appreciate your excellence. We love it. Thank you so much.
Thank you for having me. I'm so happy to be here with you all.
We're honored. Hey, how can people reach you? Would you mind?
Yes, yes. You can check me out on my website, www.uclogic, uselogic.com. You can email me at info@uclogic, or you can follow me on Instagram, Facebook, or Twitter, and soon to be TikTok once I figure out how to like do that.
Yes.
at uclogic.
You're going to be huge on TikTok. It's going to be so much fun.
I don't know, man. I mean, I am like, I do dance with reckless abandon, but yes. it's literally reckless abandon. So how
it goes. That's what the people want.
I mean, we'll see.
Thank you so much, UC.
Thank you.
Have a good rest of your evening.